Playing baseball before Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947 was no easy job. African Americans were excluded from playing Major League Baseball, especially during the reign of Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis. And even after Robinson's history-making move to the majors, segregation was still part of society overall. Negro League players faced a lot of hardships, but that didn't keep these men from playing and enjoying a game they dearly loved. Good evening, I'm Mark Haney. This is Baseball, a little-known chapter. I've had the pleasure of interviewing several of the players from the days of the Negro Leagues, and I'd like to share their stories with you. Let's start with Chris Eckes with the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame and Museum, who tells us it was a chapter of baseball history that had a huge impact on the sport.
Well, certainly the infusion of African-American talent into baseball gave the game a new feel. It was tapping into an entire talent pool that had been ignored. And you can sort of see that the teams that really embraced it, the faster they embraced it, the smarter they were about the players that they picked, their ability to scout players and bring them up, the more success they had. So there's no question from that standpoint that it impacted the way the game was played. I think also, as we see today, baseball is global. And teams are looking anywhere and everywhere for talent. And to kind of use the Negro Leagues as a microcosm of this giant group that was ignored. Now no one's ignored. We learn from that mistake. So, you know, if you're playing in Korea, we'll bring you here. Major League teams are not at all discriminatory about where they're going to look for talent. If you can help us win, we want you. And I think the success of players coming out of the Negro Leagues and, of course, the ongoing success of African-Americans in baseball and in all sports kind of symbolizes that lesson.
There was a team in Dayton, the Marcos. Cincinnati had, I think it's had several Negro League teams in the years, particularly the Clowns and the Tigers. But finding anything about these teams is really hard.
That's correct. A lot of that has to do with how they were documented at the time. Most major newspapers did not give a lot of coverage to these teams when they were in existence. There was considerable coverage in African-American papers in the cities these teams played in, but they also weren't terribly organized through long stretches of their history. When we think of baseball, we think of the American League and the National League, and it's all very well organized and documented internally. But for Negro League teams, it was a much looser structure, and that made it more difficult, really, to track what these guys were doing and when. Leagues came and went frequently. Teams came and went frequently. Players regularly jumped from one team to the next. So that lack of structure, I think, complicates our ability to go back and sort of reconstruct in detail what those leagues were all about and those teams. And when they barnstormed, which was, you know, a lot of their schedule was filled by just touring the country, kind of taking on all comers, rather than playing in a real strict league environment, they would draw big crowds. They would go to small towns, they would draw crowds. So lots and lots of people saw these guys play, to be sure.
And I think they put an emphasis on showmanship as well, because some of the teams, like the Indianapolis Clowns, were actually, I guess for lack of a better word, they were a stunt team.
They certainly made an effort to incorporate those kinds of things, some teams more than others, in their play. You mentioned the Clowns, and Goose Tatum is probably the most well-known player to come from the Clowns, and he went on to much greater fame with the Harlem Globetrotters. And a lot of the bits that we now associate with the Globetrotters were Goose Tatum innovations. And he started those as a member of the Clowns. And they would do these things during the games. They would do these things in between innings. And it was a much more relaxed atmosphere. I don't mean to keep contrasting it with Major League Baseball, but if you think of how regimented a Major League game is and all the rules governing virtually everything that a player does while he's on the field, there wasn't that kind of regimentation in the Negro Leagues, which gave fans a very different experience when they went to see these teams play. They saw great baseball and extraordinarily talented baseball players, but they also got a lot more for their money sometimes, too.
I've heard one of the stunts, for instance, might be somebody's reading a newspaper in the outfield. Ball gets hit his way, and I guess he had some way of looking over the newspaper or through it, and it would be, okay, here it comes, boink, catch the ball as it comes in. And they did things like that.
Absolutely. Josh Gibson, who is arguably, he was referred to as a Black Babe Ruth at the time. You know, so just giving an idea that these guys certainly were known because there were parallels made between players in the established major leagues and players in the Negro Leagues. Well, Gibson was called the Black Babe Ruth, and everyone who ever saw him play considered him to be every bit the power hitter that Ruth ever was. Legend has it that he hit the longest ball ever hit at Crosley Field, clear over the laundry building in left field. And no one can ever remember anyone hitting a ball like that besides Gibson.
One player told me another difference was the game was played at a faster pace as well. a lot more stealing, a lot more emphasis on precision throwing and that kind of thing.
Right. There are stories that go around about what white players thought of Negro League games when they saw them. And in one instance, a player watched a Negro League game unfold during the offseason, and he approached one of the players after the game and said, "Boy, that's really amazing how you guys do that. You don't do anything like that when you play in your season, do you?" And the response was, "Well, sure. How do you guys play?" You know, so it was. It was a very different approach to the game. We see some of those changes happening when baseball finally integrates. And we see that the game started incorporating those elements that these players grew up playing in the Negro Leagues. And it really improved the quality of Major League Baseball exponentially. So it was a wonderful thing when those facets started to come into play.
Who were some of the prominent players from the Negro Leagues? Of course, Satchel Paige is a name that often comes to mind, and you've mentioned some other players as well.
Satchel Paige is probably the best known, to be sure. Josh Gibson, also mentioning the parallels between players in the Negro Leagues and the Major Leagues, a guy by the name of John Henry Lloyd was a shortstop who was called the Black Wagner, drawing comparisons to Honus Wagner. And Wagner had a great quote about Lloyd when he was told that he was referred to as a Black Wagner. He said that he was honored that Lloyd would, paraphrasing here, but that Lloyd would be associated with him in that way. So he was turning it around, saying that from what he knew of Lloyd and what he had seen of Lloyd, Lloyd was the better player. Many people would say that Lloyd was the best player to come out of the Negro Leagues and belongs on any all-time team you ever decide to put together.
There's a gentleman who brought a businesslike attitude to the Negro Leagues that kind of gelled them together for a long stretch.
Probably Rube Foster.
Rube Foster, thank you.
Foster was a tremendous pitcher, and he saw a business opportunity behind it, and he was responsible for the formation of the first league that lasted. The first attempt at an all-Negro League goes all the way back to 1887, and that's a Cincinnati tie that one of the charter members of this league that unfortunately only lasted a couple of weeks was a team here in town called the Cincinnati Browns. And it was the League of Colored Players, I believe is what it was called. It didn't last. It fell apart quickly. And there were a couple of other attempts at creating some kind of structure for all these teams. But Rube Foster in Kansas City in 1920, originally I think it was going to start in 1921, but they got a jump on it, sat down, created a charter for a league that became the first version of the Negro National League. And it was around for about a dozen years. And sadly, his death precipitated its demise. Really, he ran the league with something of an iron fist, and all the power was kind of consolidated under him. But he made sure that teams that were struggling got the money they needed to keep going. He settled all league disputes. He really helped to eliminate players in the contract jumping, which really was a big problem for continuity's sake. A lot of times, teams were inclined not to adhere to a schedule. He was adamant about putting a schedule together and teams actually fulfilling that schedule. So he really, deservedly so, is considered the father of Negro Leagues. But he contracted a mental illness, debilitating mental illness, and wound up dying in 1926, 1927. And shortly thereafter, without his presence, the league didn't have enough infrastructure strength to survive. So it passed on. But another version of the league emerged a couple years after its last year.
The version that emerged after that, it lasted into what, the late 40s, early 50s?
Yeah, there were two other leagues that came about. The second Negro National League, I believe, started in 1933. And I want to say that it went into 1948-49. The Negro American League that formed in 1937, of which the Tigers were a charter member, that actually lasted until 1960. So that was the last formal Negro League in existence. It outlived the second version of the Negro National League.
And I guess because baseball started to integrate, there was less and less of a need for a separate league at that point.
One of the prime culprits behind the segregation of baseball was Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who became baseball commissioner in 1920. And as he always was quick to point out, there was nothing written that prohibited any team from signing a black baseball player. There was absolutely nothing to prevent that. But he said that if major league teams began that practice, that it would have the effect of destroying the Negro Leagues. And he was using it as a defense against the practice. But as it turns out, he was right, because once the major leagues began to integrate, and understandably so, all of the best players began migrating toward the better money, the better competition associated with Major League Baseball, the greater visibility, the attraction that was the Negro Leagues gradually waned. Because now if you wanted to see the best players, you went to see the major leagues.
because it was a segregated era, players in the Negro Leagues faced a lot of difficulty in traveling, finding lodging, finding places to eat.
Absolutely. So many of the stories that we hear now about what it was like for players like Jackie Robinson facing that kind of discrimination as the Dodgers moved around the country, not being able to stay in the same hotel, that kind of thing. These teams faced the very same thing. Going from city to city, they would struggle sometimes to find a place that would feed them. They would have to find a black restaurant to go to, and sometimes it could be a long wait, you know, on a bus as you're riding, being turned down again and again. Everything you've ever heard about segregation certainly applied to these players. They weren't given special treatment because they happened to be baseball players, even if they were baseball players of some renown. And this actually led a number of them to play in Mexico. Mexico was much more receptive. They didn't draw the same kind of racial lines that were drawn here. And players that went to Mexico, they got to stay in the best hotels with the team. They got to enjoy sort of that feeling of being a big league baseball player. They weren't stigmatized in any way. And that certainly had a jarring effect on them to realize that, you know, you can go somewhere else and be paid to play baseball and be treated fairly.
If I pitch, can you catch? Will you hold the ball? When you step to the plate, will you swing and fall? If you play, you gotta know how it's done. Can you catch? Can you hold a hard one? I mean, baby, do you know the game? I mean, baby.
Charlie Davis had an interesting nickname that his baseball roommate and country singer Charlie Pride gave him. That nickname was Whip, because he whipped a lot of teams in his days as a pitcher for the Memphis Red Sox in the early 1950s. Davis, who now lives in Cincinnati, says one of his best moments was pitching in the East-West All-Star Game when he relieved star pitcher Satchel Paige. His baseball career started in 1947 when he played for a team sponsored by Simmons Bedspring and Mattress in Atlanta.
They had two teams. You know, we couldn't play against the whites, but we worked together. They had a white team and a black team, and we only could play one another on the 4th of July. And you couldn't come see us play unless you worked there. They had a record of how many people in your family, and they'd give you tickets for every family in your family. So we'd always start playing 11 o'clock in the morning on the 4th of July. Had a lot of fun working together, and never was no problem. But they just didn't let black and white play together then on the same team. And we was playing, and they let the scouts come in to watch us play, Major League scouts. And a guy from the Negro League was there. After the game, he asked me, he said, how would you like to play for your living? I said, well, can you make any money? He said, how much you make now? And at that time, I was making 39 cents an hour. He looked at me and laughed. He said, well, I'm sure you can make that much. So I just didn't think no more about it. Well, during the winter months, he called me every week. Are you coming to spring training? Are you coming to spring? And I'd always say, no, I'm not coming. Until the last minute, I told him, I said, well, I got another guy that plays on team with me is much better ball player than I am, or he's good as I am. He said, well, I tell you what you do, sir. We're going to send you some money, and you pay his way, and we'll give you the money back when you get here. Well, we went to Montgomery for spring training, where all the players were staying in the college dormitory. And they had so many players, they had schedule me and him to stay in a motel. Well, one of the old players, he tricked me. So he met me at the bus station. He said, hey, Lefty. I said, yeah. He said, I know you want to meet all the guys. I said, yeah, I do. Well, I said, you stay in the dormitory and we'll take your room. And I didn't know the difference. That's what he did. We teased him about that for years. While we were staying at the college, everybody had a bunk. So manager come by and told everybody, all the pitchers, I want to be ready to hit the field at 6 o'clock in the morning. So now we got arrangement for you to go eat. You can start eating at 5. And first thing I thought, man, I got to eat a lot because they're going to wake you hard. So I went in to eat bacon and eggs and drunk me a half a quart of milk. Now I'm ready. By 9 o'clock, I done fell out. And, you know, I figured, well, he's going to send me home now. When I came to look down the line, about 4 or 5 of the older guys was laying out. So after 3 o'clock, everybody else was going in, and the guys who fell out had to stay and catch up. They had to stay and do what them other guys didn't do. So that's when the manager told him, said, now, you know, you can't eat a lot of food. He said, it'll do like it did. It'd make you sick. So the second day, they sent my friend home. And I said, well, when you going to let me go home? They said, well, we're going to keep you. So we think you got a chance. Well, the fifth day, he told me, he said, they got 27 left-handed batters, and we want you to pitch to them. And the manager stood right behind you on the mound. See, the manager told you what to throw. The catchers and the manager had signs, so the catcher would know what was coming. And some of them young guys were telling the manager, said, tell Lefty to slide up. So he got a job. Well, when they sent my friend home, I was ready to go home. And that stayed on my mind. So they broke camp, and we went to New Orleans. And that was the first time I saw Hank Aaron. He was down there. The manager said, I'm going to pitch you tonight. And said, if you do well, I'm going to let you go home. Well, all I was interested in going home. For 7 innings, I shut them out. So then the other guy had told me, if the manager come out in a hurry, he ain't going to take you out. Said, but if he take his time by getting there, say, ain't nothing going to keep you in the ball game. In the 8th inning, he come out, took his time. I was watching everything he did. And he said, Lefty, you done on your right home. Said, now I'm going to take you out and I'm going to bring Marsha Bridges in you. He the first guy I could saw could throw 97. Never let him pitch for 1 inning, but he could throw 97 miles an hour. So we go on back to the hotel. I had everything I had packed up to go home. And he told Red Moore, said, tell Lefty, come on, I'm ready to take him to the bus station. So he took me to the bus station, Greyhound bus station, and he went there and he bought 2 tickets. He come back and had me 2 tickets. Now give me your bag. What do you mean, give you my bag? He said, I know if I let you take all your stuff home, you ain't coming back. And he took my bag. He said, now, we got a ticket from you from New Orleans to Atlanta and from Atlanta to Birmingham. He said, your next scheduled day to pitch will be Sunday in Birmingham. So I came home, and I really wasn't going to worry about my clothes. I wasn't going to go back, you know. I had made up my mind, I'm going to stay home. And the guy started teasing me at home about it. He said, he didn't give you that opportunity, so they cut you loose. And I said, well, I'm going to show you. I'm going to Birmingham. So I went to Birmingham and pitched that Sunday. You know, I had never took time about being in condition to play. And what I did, you know, was, well, when you got to Atlanta, you know, you meet all them girls, you really have a good time. So about the 3rd inning of that Sunday, I could throw foot hard. And the ball would bounce before it get to the home plate. I saw the manager get up, come out laughing. He said, how you feel? I said, fine. He said, well, hell, your ball ain't getting the home plate. I said, well, I'll be all right to rest, Skip. He said, no, I'm going to take you out. He said, now you know what you can do. You know, between games, you know how you can mess around. He said, now, that's all you did when you went home. And he said, now, you know I ain't got to tell you. Between games, between your time to pitch, you got to get ready to pitch. And I never had no problem with that.
How old were you when you first started playing, Charlie?
I never forget. I was 16. Charlie Pride was 15.
Uh-huh. And he was the one who nicknamed you Whip, wasn't he?
Right.
Why was that?
Well, we never did let Charlie Pride start a ball game. He pitched, but the manager never let him start a ball game. They let him relieve. See, we would probably play an independent team on a Monday. That was maybe a Cotton Mill team. Team that thought that we couldn't beat them. They'd get their owners so much money to play them, and we could only play them on a Monday because we played league's game the rest of the month. And I had a 17-0 record that year by the time the East-West game, see. That was the first year I made the East-West game. I had a 17-0 record. And me and Charlie, every night he'd tease me about it. He said, every time you go out there, you win. See, man said, I'm going to give you a name. I said, what? He said, old Whip Davis. Just like that. I said, whoa, man. He said, you win, boy. He said, you study winning. And he started teasing me like that. And all the players started calling me that. And they still call me that now whenever they see me.
You played for Memphis, playing all over the country, Charlie?
We played all over the country. We played him on a Monday night. We played across the field on that. But I pitched that Thursday night in Indianapolis. And my cousin here, he came over and picked me and Charlie Pride up, and we came over here and stayed until Monday. Like if you was between your starting time, you could lead the team. And so we came over to his house, stayed. Him and his wife prepared breakfast for us. And that was the first time Charlie Pride had ever eaten French toast.
What was the style of baseball like in the Negro Leagues? Was it a faster, more precise kind of game? Because that's what I've read.
Yeah. It was much faster. During that time, the guys would stretch up over their head and come down here and stop, you know, when they had men on base. They changed that. They made you change that because some of them guys would get two steps off the base, and if you go up here, he'd take off and figure he could make second base by the time you got and stopped, and they could. The Clown had four guys like that, and they started us to come into your ways and stop. They could fly. One of them ran so fast, they say he broke both his legs. Now, our manager used to tease us about that. He said, you start walking them guys, so you be standing out there doing this. They be running so fast. They was good and fast. The Clowns had Murchison, who was from Cincinnati, Ensley, and they had a Cuban guy, Solid Drake. Three guys right behind one another. They never tried to hit the ball hard. They make it bounce twice. They be safe at first. I tell a guy now, you never seen no guy run like them guys run. They made you change everything. And we was always, you know, we come to our waist and stop. And if they get off too far, you step off, you had to get back. But they was something.
You may play music. You may play baseball. You better hit the right leg, boy. Don't I'll be kicking in your stall if you don't hit your right leg. Yeah, you got to hit your right leg. Nah, you better hit your right leg. Don't you can't carry no baby home.
Inquirer sports reporter John Erardi has a passion for the Negro Leagues. It started 16 years ago when he was doing research for a story that turned into something entirely bigger.
It was early 1993, different generation. I was working on a piece for Black History Month for the Inquirer, and it was supposed to be a little 10-inch piece. One day that month, and it turned into a two-section special section for our opening day coverage of 1993. And I met Tom Turner from Georgetown, Ohio, who played for the Chicago American Giants in 1947, became a close friend of his, and since then I've just fallen in love with the Negro Leagues and everything about it.
You said you met Tom Turner. What was your impression of Tom as a player and as a person?
Well, Tom back then, I mean, he, at the time in 93, was, I'm guessing, in his late 70s, maybe early 80s. I believe he's now in his early 90s, and he was a great repository of information for me because he played in 1947 when Jackie Robinson broke in and broke the color line with the Dodgers in the National League. Tom was playing at that time in Chicago, so he very much knew what that era was like. Some of the players I've met since then played in the Negro Leagues in the early 50s and mid-50s. It wasn't quite the same as it was for Tom because he very much felt the sting of racism back then. He was a really good player in the armed forces in World War II, played a lot of baseball in Mexico. And in fact, Mexico was where he made his connection to play in the Negro Leagues in Chicago. He wanted his daughter to be born in the States, so he left Mexico where he was treated very well, paid very well, and went through a much tougher time of it in the United States, especially traveling through the South, making his way north to Chicago with the American Giants in 47.
I've been amazed at the attitude. They did face a lot of hardships. They did face a lot of racism, and the thing that I always find about them, though, is that they don't seem bitter about it. They just say, hey, that was just something we had to overcome to do what we really loved.
Yeah.
Was that what you found in talking to?
Yeah, definitely. It very much mirrors the attitude I think a lot of us saw with Buck O'Neill, the late Buck O'Neill, late great Buck O'Neill, on the Ken Burns documentary, where he basically said, they asked him if he felt like he was born too early. He said, no, I was born just at the right time because I got to do what I wanted to do, which was play baseball for a living.
Baseball fulfilled me like music. I played most of my life, and I loved it. Waste no tears for me. I wasn't born too early. I was born right on time. Come on, let's play ball.
And Tom Turner was the same way. Even though they were excluded from the white major leagues, they didn't look upon it as being something that stunted their life, but rather enhanced it because they could speak about that great era of the Negro Leagues when there was some great baseball being played, in many cases even better than was played in the American and National Leagues in the Major League Baseball. So they felt blessed, and I think they felt as though their life was better because of it.
In studying the Negro Leagues and some of the players in it, how important were they to the Major Leagues themselves?
Oh, I think they were invaluable. I think Branch Rickey, who was, of course, the man that signed Jackie Robinson and brought him to the big leagues, was very much aware, as were a lot of the baseball people, that there was no question that a lot of the fellas in the Negro Leagues were major league timber. Of course, Branch Rickey had a twofold reason for wanting to bring in Jackie Robinson and later Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb, was that not only did he feel like he could do something for society by breaking the color line, but he felt as though the Dodgers could become a real force in the National League with this influx of black players. And boy, was he ever right. He had such a talent source, and the other teams are just far behind the Dodgers. And in fact, the American League was far behind the National League. And that had a big reason to do with the National League's domination over the American League in the All-Star Games, say, in the late 40s and early 50s, is that the talent of the Henry Aarons and the Willie Mays and people like that just dwarfed the American League talent because they didn't have, in their case, access to the Negro League's players. They didn't choose to go that route, and it hurt them, actually.
Now, Cincinnati has history around these teams. There was the Tigers, correct?
Right. The Tigers are my favorite team because D'Hart Hubbard, the former Olympic champion, had a major role in putting together that team for a man named Henry Ferguson, who was a hotel operator, a cab company operator, and an operator of the Cotton Club in what was then the West End, now since gone because obviously the expressway going through there. But D'Hart Hubbard, to me, is a true son, if you will, of Cincinnati. He, I think, is arguably one of our top five greatest athletes of all time, great University of Michigan athlete, great track star, and quite a baseball player, and didn't get to play with his team, of course, but assembled it and had some great connections and put together a team, which I've written about quite a bit before, that no doubt in my mind could have beaten the Cincinnati Reds team of 1936-37. There's just no doubt about that.
That's interesting. You mentioned the Reds team of 36 and 37, which I don't think they were too good.
No, they weren't very good. They got good in late 38 and then building their way to 39 and 40 when they're in the World Series. But I've always believed that Tigers team of 36-37 had the greatest compilation of pitching talent ever to come out of this city at one time. They had pitchers like Porter Moss, Jess Houston, Roy Partlow, Lou Dula. They were great players. Some of them went on to pitch for the Pittsburgh teams of the great Negro Leagues, and they made this a great team here in Cincinnati. Short-lived team, only a full year in the inaugural season of the Negro American League, but were in the minor leagues and 35 and 36, and they didn't have a long schedule. They might have went about 19 and 10 that season, but they would go east, and as one of the players told me, we'd go up there and kick butt and take names.
Well, they only lasted a year. What
right.
happened?
I think what happened was financially they couldn't afford it. It was the end of the Great Depression. The money wasn't there. I don't know how deep Henry Ferguson's pockets were. He was largely the bankroll for that team, and it was just a tough existence. They drove a bus that was formerly the possession of a music group called the McKinley Cotton Pickers. That bus would break down on occasion. They would take it all the way to New York and New Jersey to play baseball games, and they'd go down south and play. But I think money was just hard to come by. They later morphed into the Memphis Red Sox, which went on to win championships down there in Memphis. So those players had a long life. They had some great young players in particular and did great things. They were a really exciting, fun group to watch, from what I'm told of some early survivors who saw that team play.
Where did the Tigers play their games?
They played a lot of their games right at Crosley Field. I mean, there was another site where they practiced. I don't know exactly where that was, but they would play doubleheaders on Sundays at Crosley Field where the Reds played when the Reds went out of town. And it was interesting. I talked to some Reds players from that 37-38 team who didn't even know that the Tigers existed. I mean, literally, the team was gone on the road, speaking of the Reds, and they made way for the Negro League team, the Tigers, to come in and play. And the team wore hand-me-down uniforms, and it was quite a festive occasion when those teams came into play on the weekends. Big crowds turned out, as many as 10,000 or 15,000 people. It was a focal point for the weekend activity for the black community in particular. And as I say, they played some wonderful a ball, exciting ball, and I sure wish I could have been here to see that.
Was there any relationship between the Cincinnati Tigers and Rube Foster? Did he have any connection with them at all?
Not that I found. I mean, arguably, he may have. Cincinnati was an early member of the first Negro League, I think, which Foster was behind. I don't remember the name of that team. It might have been the Cincinnati Cubans, and they played here for a short time. And then, of course, after the Tigers, there were the Cincinnati Indianapolis Clowns. And I think Foster probably had some kind of connection with Cincinnati. This was such a great baseball city. They felt they could make it work here, but I don't know exactly what that connection was.
You think Rube Foster, because of his, from what I read, he had a pretty good business sense. You think he was a turning point for the Negro Leagues?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it. It's guys like him that had a vision of what the Negro Leagues could be that really made it came to life and live. And there were great entrepreneurs in other cities, Pittsburgh in particular. I mentioned Henry Ferguson here in Cincinnati. Memphis had a couple of doctor brothers who were instrumental in bringing that team to town and keeping it alive. And I think that's why teams lasted longer in certain cities, is that there was some black businessman, or in some case white businessman, who had deeper pockets and could keep it alive. And it was a source of not only a joy and love for the black community, if you will, but also a source of finances for the owners of the teams. I think in places especially like Kansas City and Memphis, Pittsburgh, where they drew so well, that was a money-making operation. In fact, in Cincinnati, I think that was part of the problem, was it was a little slower catching on because the pockets weren't deep enough. They couldn't keep it going.
Yes, Jackie hit that ball.
And when he swung his bat, the crowd went wild because he knocked that ball a solid mile. Yeah, boy.
Yes, yes, Jackie hit that ball.
Satchel Paige's mellow, so is Campanella. Newcomb and Dobie, too. But it's a natural fact, when Jackie comes to bat, the other team is through.
Did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Did he hit it? Yes! And that ain't all, he's so whole!
Yes, yes, Jackie's real gone.
During the 1940s, when segregation was prevalent in America, some African-American players got a warm welcome south of the border. Such was the case of Thomas Turner, who now lives in Georgetown, Ohio. Turner came from an athletic family and was involved in baseball, football, and basketball. After serving in the Army, he was invited to play baseball in Mexico, where he says the fan enthusiasm was strong. But family matters brought him back to the U.S.
And then I went to Chicago. And a boy that was in the service with me in pitch service, Walter McCoy, was the first thing I saw when I walked in the Chicago American Giants camp. And we went to Jackson, Mississippi for spring training. That's where we spring trained in 47. And then from there, we opened up April in Chicago. And then we come to April to open up in Kansas City. That's where our museum is now. So here was Walter McCoy, the boy that pitched baseball in the service with me, the same team. There he was standing tall with with Chicago American Giants. Then last year, he's still alive also. He's a carpenter. He builds homes and still trying to play ball.
What's the most memorable thing that ever happened when you were playing in the Negro Leagues? You faced a lot of good pitching. I think Satchel Paige was even one of them.
Yeah, Satchel Paige was one. Floyd, a guy by the name of Floyd. This guy that just lost his life, he was the first baseman for Kansas City Monarchs, Buck O'Neill. If it wasn't for Buck, we wouldn't have a museum or any of those things. He is the one, after he stopped playing baseball, got going everywhere, getting money for this museum. And where they built the museum, it used to be a nightclub there. And the big bands would come there and play all night, everything. But they turned it into a museum. And they built a ball diamond inside of the museum and put bronze figures at each one of the positions. And they put names down on the floor right in front of the guy. And right across the street from that is a theater. And that's where you can see all the old films from a long time ago in the Negro League baseball. And it's something. And Buck still had it. He was here in Dayton, Ohio about 2 years ago, raising money. And people would help him.
What were some of the other teams you played when you were playing for the Chicago Giants?
We had a lot of teams. There was Memphis. There was Birmingham. There was the Clowns. The Clowns had two women play Negro League. One was the pitcher and the other was the second baseman. And the second baseman was just as good a hitter as any man you want to see. And she was a small woman. I can't remember all the teams, but I can tell you the different people. In 1975, they had the 75th anniversary for the Negro League. They had 244 guys there representing the Negro League. We were there for 4 days, and we didn't do anything but eat and tell lies. We had a good time. And out of that group, I think it was about only six wheelchairs, guys that couldn't walk, out of 400 and some people. And the last one we had was one day. It was 155 guys. That was in the 2000. And it's more than that now. You look around, you see one died here, one died here. Double Duty Radcliffe, he was out of Chicago. He's passed away. He would catch a doubleheader. And when the other game would start, he'd pitch and was good. And that's why they gave him that man. He'd catch one game and pitch the other game.
Well, speaking of nicknames, you were High Pocket Turner.
Oh, man, don't tell me about that High Pocket business. I get letters right now, 3 and 4 letters a day from all over wanting me to sign these things. I sign them, though, and send them back to them. This was from the service. In 1943, they set up a camp at Santa Barbara for all the wounded soldiers to come back from overseas. And in order to entertain them, they scheduled this Ninth Service Command World Series at Santa Barbara. And there wasn't anything there but women, girls. There was mothers and sisters and brothers and sweethearts and everything. And they were all in a big place there, just as much as you could see, right on the Pacific Ocean. And every time I'd go down to first base, I was playing first base then. The women would stand up and wave and say, "Hey, High Pocket." The women gave me that name. Well, somebody put it on the web, and they write to me, "Mr. Thomas Turner, High Pocket." I won't put no High Pocket on. I would just sign my name on them. See? 2 years ago in Chicago, it was a whole line of us autographing. Autographing everything, shoes, socks, shirts, everything. Anybody, whatever anybody wanted, we'd do that all day long. Well, I wouldn't charge anybody anything. The other guys did, but I wouldn't. So that's where the High Pocket thing came from. I still get these papers.
Did you really enjoy playing in the Negro Leagues? How'd you feel about your years there?
I could enjoy playing because I could execute. I could play first base and I could hit the baseball. I'm not bragging. Anytime I walk up at that plate, I was going to hit the ball somewhere. I was going to hit the ball, and I knew I was going to hit the ball. I wasn't a long ball hitter. I only had one home run the whole year that I played. I had one, and that was in Comiskey Park during that opening day in April. I hit one up in the triple deck out of left field. That's the only home run I had in my life. I could have told a lot of lies about that, but I wouldn't. Little kids asked me, how many home runs did you hit? I said, make a guess. And they hold up, 20? All right. I said, no, you're way off. More than that? And I'd let them go. Then I'd tell them, I said, you want to really know, want to know? They say, yeah, I do this.
One?
One.
Who was the best pitcher you ever faced?
Well, three of them. Bullet Rogan, Satchel Paige, and another one on Kansas City Monarchs. I forget his name all the time. He had the name of a motel, and he was good. Satchel would start a game and pitch three innings, and he would come on and pitch the other six innings. Satchel wouldn't pitch no more than three innings. And Satch pitched balls, to me, was easy to hit because he had excellent control. I didn't have to dodge him or play hot spots, you know, or have him throwing at me. He was coming in with the ball. And most times, they don't know this. I try to get the kids to know this. If there's a pitcher anywhere, he want to get his first pitch in as a strike. You see what I mean? A lot of managers want you to wait. We didn't wait. We could hit whenever we wanted to hit, and we could steal whenever we wanted to steal. We didn't have to wait for a steal signal. I could steal bases with ease and hit the ball with him. Singles, doubles, I could do that between the fielders. But I quit in 1954 because of one thing. I struck out 4 straight times, and I knew then it was time for me to quit trying to play baseball. I struck out 4 times in a row. So that was the end of my playing baseball.
Do you miss playing baseball?
No, because I wouldn't like what's going on now. I wouldn't like that at all. There's no sportsmanship in this stuff anymore. I see fights. I've never seen a fight when we were playing, whether we got beat or whether we didn't. I've never seen these guys fight. It's just like a family. So I don't really miss it.
Gentlemen, we're gathered here today to honor Satchel Paige and all he gave and all his deeds and all the years he played in the Negro Leagues. Oh, my, wasn't it a shame how Jim Crow ran the game? No one's to blame, and anyway, he was the best you'd ever see in the Negro Leagues. He's in. 3 up, 3 down. I'll get you home by dark. And any of you ladies want to take me out celebrating after, you just come round the door.
Hey, Josh, you know what I hear? I hear the boys up in the majors got a man who drives the bus. That's all he does. And they don't drive the whole night through the day they play the game. And they don't play no better than us.
Bunny Warren has seen a lot of things in life. Born in Covington, Kentucky, he remembers from his childhood the Great Flood of 1937 when the Ohio River swamped many a town along its banks. His baseball career also covered a lot of ground as he played for the Detroit Stars, the Indianapolis Clowns, and the semi-professional Cincinnati Tigers. He got to watch as the integration of the major leagues brought on the end of the Negro Leagues. He had the good fortune to be drafted by the Brooklyn Dodgers, but the misfortune to be on a team that was already rich at his infield position, shortstop. He found himself stuck behind Pee Wee Reese at the top of the line
and players like Don Zimmer in between.
I played for a local team here called the Cincinnati Tigers, and they were a semi-pro outfit. And we played a lot of the Negro League ball clubs. That's how I got connected with them. We were in Indianapolis, and we were playing the Clowns up there on the part of the doubleheader. Sometimes they have doubleheaders when they play one team, then another team comes in and plays the second game. So we played the second game up there. And I got the attention of a few guys that played with their Clowns. And they approached me and asked me, did I want to play a professional ball? Well, we were playing semi-professional, but I still had to go to a job, and I had a young wife at home, you know. But when my job gave out that summer, I couldn't find work. That's when I went on the road, started playing baseball. Stayed out there for maybe a couple of years. But the only major league teams I would think that interested me was the Negro League ball clubs, because they were more closer to you. They talk with you, you know, and sometimes if you're lucky, you could bat boy for them, you know. And a lot of guys would try to get down there early to make that 50 cents so they could bat boy all day and maybe even get a broken bat. And as time went on, things started changing. But I enjoyed watching the Negro League teams play because they were a lot of joy to watch, and I decided that I wanted to play baseball when I get to be a man. I never had any idea that the major leagues would be opening to a black man at that point in time, you know, because if I got to the Negro leagues, I was satisfied because that's all I've seen, that's all I know. And as time went on, you know, things started looking pretty good. So I just grew up with the idea baseball was something that I wanted to be and something that I wanted to do. But it took a lot of work. It took a lot of work because majority of the kids in the neighborhood, they could play. They were outstanding players. They played every day. You know, you had to be good, you know. And the ones who really cared for the game, they went a long way with it. There was a couple guys that I had known personally. They were older men. Merchant, Henry Merchant was one of them. He played with a team called the Clowns, Indianapolis Clowns. People think, well, they're clowns. Don't let that deceive you, because they had players on that team. And one of the most outstanding players that came off that team in later years, and you wouldn't believe who he was, Hank Aaron. People say, well, you know, they just clown. But they had more going for them as far as people coming through the gate, because they had an act. They had King Tuck and Henry Merchant. He would run a horse. And they had different things for you to do other than watching a doubleheader, you know. And speaking about doubleheaders, we saw a doubleheader every Sunday almost when the Negro teams come to town. But now, if you want to see a doubleheader, you got to pay twice to see it now. And in Major League Baseball, you know, they empty the park and bring you back if you wanted to come. But you just pay maybe the 75 cent to go in the ballpark, and it's a doubleheader on Sunday. You could see both games. No problem at all. Games didn't start on a Sunday when I was playing until after 1 o'clock, simply because you had the church people in church, and you wanted to get them the service time so they could come to watch the ball game later on. It couldn't start at 11:30 or 12 o'clock, you know. They had to start at 1 o'clock or better. So that way, if you started at 12 o'clock, you would lose a lot of patronage. Starting about 1 o'clock or 1:30, the people that went to church, they would come to the ballpark. That's why in old books you see that a lot of the guys and a lot of the gentlemen and ladies, they were dressed up when they came to the ballpark. You know, wonder why these people dressed up. It's almost 90 degrees out here. You know? But that was the reason for that, you know. Straight from church, had a little baskets, would have been everything, you know. Especially that was so true as far as the South was concerned, you know, because they were orientated to go to church. I mean, it's just a heritage about them. And I like going South playing ball because the food was excellent. You just ate home-cooked food all the time. But when you come north, if you got a restaurant you can run into, you know, and the meals wasn't bad. I mean, anything's good to you when you're hungry. You done played a doubleheader, you might have gotten a dollar and a half for food to eat, you know what I mean? Maybe 75 cents, all depends on how the money was at the gate. So you try to find something that's going to be very wholesome for you. And most of the time, you know, you found a nice restaurant. And I liked the part about it gave me exposure when I went to the Detroit Stars. I didn't never think that I would see the western side of the hemisphere. I mean, of course, Cincinnati, Kentucky, Indiana, that's far as I ever thought I would ever go, you know. I'm looking up one day, and I'm going into Canada. And, you know, Canada, I'm going across the border. As a kid, man, a young man, you know, this was something unheard of, you know. I mean, a lot of people live in Detroit, they know these things, but I live in Ohio, you know what I mean? This is almost in the South. And so this was very educational as far as I'm concerned, the things that I've been taught about in school and just geographies and things, you know. And all of a sudden, I'm getting a chance to see these things. And that was very good for me because I'm looking, when you go to sleep at night on the bus, you wake up, you don't know where you are. Next day, you wake up, where the hell are we? Excuse my language, but you might be somewhere. If you're going west out of Indianapolis, chances are you're going to wind up in St. Louis or places in that nature, you know what I mean, going west. Kansas City, that was a stop we had to make. And, well, we go to west as far as to the upper northwest, to the Dakotas, and that takes you into Canada. That's the swing that we would normally make twice a year. In order to get back down on the east side of the country, we would go through New York to Canada, back down through New York, down to Pennsylvania, some places like that, because they had teams in that area where you could play at. But it gave me the thrill of my life. I was thinking about that not too long ago. And it's funny how kids are today than they were in my era. I think we were always wanting to do something. It's nothing that was adventure, that something that we could more or less enjoy doing and be able to tell people that we were proud to do this here. To me, baseball was one of them. I never had any idea that I was going to be a Negro League ball player. I was more or less looking for something else like they had during the war. They had the teams that played at home, and you still had a job working in war plants and things like that. You didn't have to travel, but you could play on Sundays and things of this nature because the plants sponsor teams. So you were doing something you like and right here at home, too. I was just elated to know that somebody thought enough of me to give me a job playing baseball. And I got to say I worked hard for it. I worked really, really hard because you had to, because there was only so many jobs and so many spaces on the bus that you could go and you know, to take a seat and get to, you know. And the guys in my era, they wanted to play. They really wanted to play. It didn't matter, you know, bad weather, inclement situations and things like this here. They wanted to play because baseball is what they love. They felt like, yeah, I can get on a bus and go from here to there and put the uniform on, give you a little cheer. That don't mean nothing. You want to be between the stripes. At least I did. Well, he's a good ball player, but if I'm not playing, that don't mean nothing to me. I want to play. And then later on in years, Jackie Robinson came up. Then everything started changing then. And it was a good deal. It was a good thing for everybody because the team started making money because at that point in time, they weren't getting the clientele as far as black people was concerned as the Negro Leagues were. But when Jackie Robinson came into the league, that changed over. Now they want to see the kid that's playing in the major league that is black. So this is something that, hey, wait a minute, this is not happening here and not in America. But it did. And so all the people who supported the Negro Leagues at the time, Jackie Robinson, they're mad now. So every chance they got, they were going into major league ballparks watching this black kid play baseball. And so that kind of grew throughout the whole country. And I got to say, and take my hats off to him, because had not he made that on the first shot, we probably would never be ready again, you know. But he did. He was a gentleman, a scholar. He had been in service, an officer. I can't think of anyone else who could have made that other than him. It may have been, but he did it. And he opened the doors for a lot of people. Even today, the president that we have now, Obama. If he had failed, I've been thinking maybe Obama wouldn't have been president maybe in another 100 years, you know what I mean? But that happened. Black man was going to different teams, Milwaukee, the Reds, all the teams were getting black personnel so they can fill their parks up. And not only that, they could play. They can really and truly play. I just want nobody's going to walk into the park and say, here I am, just give me a bat so we can swing. No, can you play? You could play. You had it going on for you. And majority of guys that came into the major league after Jackie Robinson, all of them was good sound ball players. They not only could play, but they had the temperament to realize the fact what was going on at that point in time. And I take my hat off to him. Whether I could have done it or not, I'm not sure. But he did it. And I tell you the truth, I'm iron for it, really, because I don't know if I could have took it if I had only the Lord only knows. But I tell you, he destroyed the Negro League, too, because they got all the guys that was good off the Negro League right over there, you know what I mean? And it was no more than right, because if something had to go well, where else could he have went and made $50,000? Definitely not the Negro League.
So how important is this chapter of baseball history? John Erardi says it's critical.
Because unless you understand who these guys were, you cannot appreciate how far the game has come. I mean, the game, in my mind, largely ultimately led this country to its civil rights legislations, to its acceptance of, if you will, African-Americans into the community at large. And the Tigers, who to some extent played in front of black crowds, also played in front of some white fans. And I've talked to some of those people who went to those games, and they feel as though, even though the Negro Leagues were overlooked in terms of the baseball talent being allowed to play in the major leagues, they recognized that they were seeing a source of talent that wasn't going to be there that much longer. They could sense that the time was coming when the blacks would be integrated into the white community and the white major leagues. And to that extent, it was almost as though this was a treasure, which we didn't see enough of here in Cincinnati. But it was something that the people in town here, I think, really appreciated.
The Negro Leagues had vanished by the early 1960s, but not their legacy. Today, Major League Baseball recognizes the contributions of these players with events like the Civil Rights Game, which this year will be hosted at Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati on June 20th. There will also be a traveling exhibit at the Reds Hall of Fame from the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. Perhaps the most lasting legacy, though, is the grace of the players themselves. Men like Charlie Davis, Thomas Turner, and Bunny Warren, many of whom looked at the hardships of their time as just one of those things they had to deal with because their love for the game of baseball is what mattered most. You've been listening to Baseball, a Little-Known Chapter, produced by Lee Hay, with technical assistance from Seniors with a Purpose, the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County, and Kevin Rowinski. I'm Mark Haney. See you at the ballpark.